Mudrin studied the photograph a long while.
What do you have here? 8 successive settlement sites?
7, Balak blurted. 9, I think, said Sephara curtly. But I agree it gets pretty difficult to tell down toward the base of the hill. We'll need chemical analysis to clear it up, and radiographic testing. But obviously there was a whole series of conflagrations here, and the Thombo people went on building and rebuilding, time after time.
But this site must have been incredibly ancient, if that's the case,
Mudrin said. My guess is that the occupation period was a span of at least 5,000 years, perhaps much more, perhaps 10 or 15. We won't know until we've fully uncovered the lowest level, and that'll have to wait for the next expedition, or the one after that.
5,000 years, you say? Can it be?
To build and rebuild again? Well, 5,000 years at a minimum.
But no site we've ever excavated anywhere in the world is remotely as old as that,
Mudrin said, looking startled.
Beklamat itself is less than 2,000 years old, isn't that so? And we regard it as the oldest known human settlement on Kalgash.
The oldest known settlement, Sephara said. But what's to say that there aren't older ones, much older ones? Mudrin, this photo gives you your own answer. Here's a site that has to be older than Beklamat. There are Beklamat-style artifacts in its highest level, and it goes down a long way from there. Beklamat must be a very recent settlement as human history goes. The Thombo settlement, which was ancient before Beklamat ever existed, must have been burned and burned and burned again, and was rebuilt every time, down through what must have been hundreds of generations.
A very unlucky place, then, Mudrin observed. Hardly beloved of the gods, was it?
Eventually, that must have occurred to them, Balak said.
Sephara nodded. Yes, finally they must have decided there was a curse on the place. So instead of rebuilding it after the last fire in the series, they moved a short distance away and built Beklamat. But before that, they must have occupied Thombo a long, long time. We were able to recognize the architectural styles of the two topmost settlements. See, it's Cyclopean Middle Beklamat here and Proto-Beklamat Crosshatch beneath. But the third town down, what there is left of it, is like nothing I can identify. The fourth is even stranger and very crude. The fifth makes the fourth look sophisticated by comparison. Below that, everything's such a primitive jumble that it's not easy to tell which town is which. But each one is separated by a burn line from the one above it, or so we think. And the tablets.
Yes, the tablets,
Mudrin said, trembling with excitement. We found this set, the square ones, in the third level. The oblong ones came from the fifth one. I can't even begin to make any sense out of them, of course, but I'm no paleographer.
How wonderful it would be, Balak began, if these tablets contained some kind of account of the destruction and rebuilding of the Thombo towns, and
Sephara shot him a poisonous glance. How wonderful it would be, Balak, if you wouldn't spin cozy little wish-fulfilling fantasies like that.
I'm sorry, Sephara, he said icily. Forgive me for breathing.
Mudrin took no heed of their bickering. He was at Sephara's desk, head bent low over the square tablets for a long while, then over the oblong ones. Finally, the paleographer said,
Astonishing! Absolutely astonishing!
Can you read them? Sephara asked. The old man chuckled.
Read them? Of course not. Do you want miracles? But I see word groups here.
Yes, so did I, Sephara said.
And I can almost recognize letters. Not on the old tablets. They're done in a completely unfamiliar script. Very likely a syllabic one. Too many different characters for it to be alphabetic. But the square tablets seem to be written in a very primitive form of the Beklamat script. See, this is a kuhas here. I'd almost be willing to wager on it. And this appears to be a somewhat distorted form of the letter tifyak. It is a tifyak, wouldn't you say? I need to work on these, Sephara, with my own lighting equipment, my cameras, my scanning screens. May I take them with me?
Take them? She said, as if he had asked to borrow some of her fingers.
It's the only way I can begin to decipher them.
Do you think you can decipher them? Balak asked.
I offer no guarantees, but if this character is a tifyak, and this a Kuhas. Then I should be able to find other letters, ancestral to the Beklemat ones, and at least produce a transliteration. Whether we can understand the language once we read the script, oh, that's hard to say. And I doubt I can get very far with the oblong tablets unless you've uncovered a bilingual that will give me some way of approaching this even older script. But let me try, Sephira. Let me try.
Yes, here. Lovingly, she gathered up the tablets and put them back in the container in which she had carried them all the way from Sajikan. It pained her to let them go out of her possession. But Mudrin was right. He couldn't do anything with them at a quick glance. He had to subject them to laboratory analysis. She watched ruefully until the paleographer had gone doddering from the room, his precious bundle clasped close against his hollow chest. Now she and Balik were alone again.
Sephira, about what I said before.
I told you to forget it. I already have. Do you mind if I get about my work now, Balik?
13. Well, how did he take it?
Theramin asked.
Better than you expected he would, is my guess.
He was completely marvelous, said Binet. They were on the terrace at the Six Suns Club. The rains had ended for the time being, and the evening was a splendid one, with the strange clarity of the atmosphere that always came after a prolonged period of rain. Tano and Setha in the west casting their hard, white, ghostly light with more than usual intensity, and Red Dovim in the opposing sector of the dusky sky, burning like a tiny gem. He hardly even seemed upset, except when I indicated that I'd almost been tempted to suppress the whole thing for the sake of protecting his feelings. Then he flew off the handle. He really chewed me out, as I deserved. But the funniest thing was, waiter, Tano special for me, please, and one for my friend. Make them doubles.
You're really turning into a drinker, aren't you? Theramin remarked.
Binet shrugged. Only when I'm here. There's something about this terrace, the view of the city, the whole atmosphere.
That's how it begins. You get to like it little by little. You develop jolly associations between one particular place and drinking. And then after a while, you experiment with having a drink or two somewhere else. And then a drink or three.
Theramin, you sound like an apostle of flame. They think drinking's evil too, don't they?
They think everything's evil. But drinking certainly is. That's what's so wonderful about it, eh, my friend?
Theramin laughed.
You were telling me about Aethor.
Yes, the really comical thing. Do you remember that wild notion you had that some unknown factor might be pushing Kalgash away from the orbit we'd expect it to have?
The invisible giant, yes. The dragon huffing and puffing in the sky.
Well, Aethor took exactly the same position.
He thinks there's a dragon in the sky?
Binet guffawed. Don't be silly, but some sort of unknown factor, yes. A dark sun, maybe, or some other world that's located at a position that's impossible for us to see, but which nevertheless is exerting gravitational force on Kalgash.
Isn't that all a little on the fantastic side? Theramin asked.
Of course it is, but Aethor reminded me of the old philosophical chestnut of Thargola's sword, which we use, metaphorically I mean, to smite the more complex premise when we're trying to decide between two hypotheses. It's simpler to go looking for a dark sun than it is to have to produce an entirely new theory of universal gravitation. And therefore,
a dark sun? But isn't that a contradiction in terms? A sun is a source of light. If it's dark, how can it be a sun?
But that's just one of the possibilities Aethor tossed at us. It isn't necessarily one that he takes seriously. What we've been doing these last few days is throwing around all kinds of astronomical notions, hoping that one of them will make enough sense so that we can begin to put together an explanation for... Look, there's Sheeran.
Binet waved at the rotund psychologist who had just entered the club.
Sheeran! Sheeran! Come out here and have a drink with us, will you?
Sheeran stepped carefully through the narrow doorway.
So you've taken up some new vices, have you, Binet?
Oh, not many, but Theramin's exposed me to the Tano special, and I'm afraid I've caught a taste for it. You know Theramin, don't you? He writes the column in the Chronicle.
I don't think we've actually met,
Sheeran said. He offered his hand.
I've certainly heard a lot about you, though. I'm Raista 717's uncle.
The psych professor, Theramin said. You've been at the Jungler Exposition, right?
Sheeran looked startled.
You keep up with everything, don't you?
I try to.
The waiter was back.
What can we get you, Tano special?
Oh, too strong for me, Sheeran said, and a little too sweet. Do you have a Neltiger by any chance?
The Jonglorian brandy? Oh, I'm not sure. How do you want it if I can find some?
Straight, said Sheeran, please.
To Theremin and Bine, he said, I've developed a liking for it while I was up north.
The food's awful in Jonglore, but at least they can distill a decent brandy.
I hear they've had a lot of trouble at the exposition, Theremin said. Some problem in their amusement park, a ride through darkness that was driving people crazy, literally driving them out of their heads.
At the Tunnel of Mystery, yes. That was the reason I was there, as a consultant called in by the city and its lawyers for an opinion. Theremin sat forward.
Is it true that people were dying of shock in that tunnel, and they kept it open anyway?
Everyone's been asking me that, replied Sheeran. There were a few deaths, yes, but they didn't seem to harm the ride's popularity. People insisted on taking the ride anyway, and a lot of them came out very badly deranged. I took a ride in the Tunnel of Mystery myself, he said, shuddering. Well, they've shut the thing down now. I told them it was either that or fork over millions of credits and liability suits. That it was absurd to expect people to be able to tolerate darkness at that level of intensity. They saw the logic of that.
We do have some Neltiger, sir, the waiter broke in, putting a glass of somber brownish brandy on the table in front of Sheeran. Just one bottle, so you'd better go easy.
The psychologist nodded and scooped up his drink, downing about half of it before the waiter had left the table.
Sir, I said.
Sheeran smiled at him.
I heard what you said. I'll take it easier after this one.
He turned to Binet.
I understand there was some excitement at the observatory while I was up north. Lilith told me. She wasn't too clear on what was going on. Some new theory, I think, she said.
Grinning, Binet said, Theremin and I were just talking about that. Not a new theory, no. A challenge to an established one. I was running some calculations on Kalgash's orbit and... Sheeran listened to the story with increasing astonishment.
The theory of universal gravitation's invalid?
He cried when Binet was halfway through.
Good Lord, man! Does that mean that if I put my glass down, it's likely to go floating up into the sky?
I'd better finish off my Neltiger first, then. And he did. Binet laughed. The theory's still on the books. What we're trying to do, what Aethor is trying to do, he's been spearheading the work, and it's amazing to watch him go at it, is to come up with a mathematical explanation for why our figures don't come out the way we think they ought to.
Massaging the data, I think it's called, Theremin added.
Sounds suspicious to me, Sheeran said. You don't like the results, so you rearrange your findings. Is that it, Binet? Make everything fit by hook or by crook?
Well, not exactly.
Admit it! Admit it!
Sheeran roared with laughter.
Waiter, another Neltiger, and one more tunnel special for my unethical young friend here. Theremin, can I get you a drink, too?
Please.
Sheeran said in the same broad tone as before,
This is all very disillusioning, Binet. I thought it was only us psychologists who made the data fit the theories and called the result science. Seems more like something the Apostles of Flame might do.
Sheeran, cut it out.
The Apostles claim to be scientists, too, Theremin put in.
Binet and Sheeran turned to look at him.
Last week, just before the rain started, I had an interview with one of their big people, he went on. I had hoped to see Mondior, but I got a certain Follman 66 instead. Their public relations man. Very slick, very bright, very personable. He spent a half an hour explaining to me that the Apostles have reliable scientific proof that next year, on the 19th of Theptar, the suns are going to go out, and we'll all be plunged into darkness and everyone will go insane.
The whole world turned into one big tunnel of mystery, is that it?
Sheeran said jovially.
We won't have enough mental hospitals to hold the entire population, you know, or enough psychiatrists to treat them. Besides, the psychiatrists will be crazy, too.
Aren't they already? Binet asked.
Good point, said Sheeran.
The madness isn't the worst of it, Theremin said. According to Follman, the sky will be filled with something called stars that will shoot fire down upon us and set everything ablaze. And there will be a world full of gibbering maniacs wandering around in cities that are burning down around our ears. Thank heaven it's nothing but Mondior's bad dream.
But what if it isn't?
Sheeran said, suddenly sobering. His round face grew long and thoughtful.
What if there's something to it?
What an appalling notion, Binet said. I think it calls for another drink.
You haven't finished the one you've got,
Sheeran reminded the young astronomer. Well, what of it? It still calls for another one afterward.
Waiter! Waiter!
14. Athor 77 felt fatigue sweeping through him in shimmering waves. The observatory director had lost all track of time. Had he really been at his desk 16 straight hours? And yesterday the same, and the day before. That was what Nyilda claimed anyway. He had spoken to her just a little while before. His wife's face on the screen had been tense, drawn, unmistakably worried. Won't you come home for a rest, Athor? You've been going at it practically around the clock.
Have I?
You aren't a young man, you know.
I'm not a senile one either, Nyilda. And this is exhilarating work. After a decade of initialing budget reports and reading other people's research papers, I'm finally doing some real work again. I love it.
She looked even more troubled. But you don't need to be doing research at your age. Your reputation is secure, Athor.
Ah, is it?
Your name will be famous in the history of astronomy forever.
Or infamous,
he said balefully.
Athor, I don't understand what you...
Let me be, Nyilda. I'm not going to keel over at my desk, believe me. I feel rejuvenated by what I'm doing here, and it's work that only I can do. If that sounds pig-headed, so be it. But it's absolutely essential that I...
She sighed. Yes, of course, but don't overdo it, Athor. That's all I ask.
Was he overdoing it, he wondered now? Yes, yes, of course he was. There wasn't any other way. You couldn't dabble in these matters. You had to throw yourself wholeheartedly into them. When he was working out universal gravitation, he had worked 16, 18, 20-hour days for weeks on end, sleeping only when sleep became unavoidable, snatching brief naps and awakening ready and eager for work, with his mind still bubbling with the equations he had left unfinished a little while before. But he had been only 35 or so then. He was nearly 70 now. There was no denying the inroads of age. His head ached. His throat was dry. There was a nasty pounding in his chest. Despite the warmth of his office, his fingertips were chilly with weariness. His knees were throbbing. Every part of his body protested the strain he had been putting on it. Just a little while longer today, he promised himself, and then I'll go home. Just a little while longer. Postulate 8.
Sir?
What is it?
He asked. But his voice must have turned the question into some sort of fierce snarl, for when he glanced around, he saw a young Emot standing in the doorway doing a bizarre series of wild twitches and convulsions, as though he were dancing on hot embers. There was terror in the boy's eyes. Of course, Emot always seemed intimidated by the observatory director. Everybody around here was, not just graduate students. And Athor was used to it. Athor was awesome, and he knew it. But this went beyond the ordinary. Emot was gazing at him in undisguised fear, mingled with what seemed like astonishment. Emot struggled visibly to find his voice and said huskily,
The calculations you wanted, sir.
Oh, yes, yes. Here, give me.
Athor's hand was trembling violently as he reached for the printouts Emot had brought him. Both of them stared at it aghast. The long bony fingers were pale as death, and they were quivering with a vehemence that not even Emot, famed for his remarkable nervous reactions, could have equaled. Athor willed his hand to be still, but it would not. He might just as well have been willing Onos to spin backward across the sky. With an effort, he snatched the papers from Emot and slapped them down on the desk. Emot said,
If there's anything I can get you, sir...
Medication, you mean? How dare you suggest...
I just meant something to eat... Or maybe a cold drink?
Emot said in a barely audible whisper. He backed slowly away as if expecting Athor to growl and leap for his throat.
I see. No, I'm fine, Emot. Fine.
Yes, sir.
The student went out. Athor closed his eyes a moment, took three or four deep breaths, struggled to calm himself. He was near the end of his task, of that he was sure. These figures that he had asked Emot to work out for him were almost certainly the last confirmation he needed. But the question now was whether the work was going to finish him before he finished the work. He looked at Emot's numbers. Three screens sat before him on his desk.
On the left-hand one was the orbit of Kalgash as calculated according to conventional reckoning under the theory of universal gravitation, outlined in blazing red. On the right-hand screen, in fiery yellow, was the revised orbit that Binet had produced, using the new university computer and the most recent observations of Kalgash's actual position. The middle screen carried both orbits plotted one over the other. In the past 5 days, Athor had produced 7 different postulates to account for the deviation between the theoretical orbit and the observed one, and he could call up any of those 7 postulates on the middle screen with a single keystroke. The trouble was that all 7 of them were nonsense, and he knew it. Each one had a fatal flaw at its heart, an assumption that was there not because the calculations justified it, but only because the situation called for some such sort of special assumption in order to make the numbers turn out the right way. Nothing was provable. Nothing was confirmable. It was as though in each case he had simply decreed at some point in the chain of logic that a fairy godmother would step in and adjust the gravitational interactions to account for the deviation. In truth, that was precisely what Athor knew he needed to find. But it had to be a real fairy godmother. Postulate 8 now. He began keying in Emot's calculations. Several times his trembling fingers betrayed him and he made an error, but his mind was still sharp enough to tell him instantly that he had hit the wrong key, and he backed up and repaired the damage each time. Twice as he worked, he nearly blacked out from the intensity of his effort, but he forced himself to go on. "You are the only person in the world who can possibly do this," he told himself as he worked. "And so you must." It sounded foolish to him, and madly egocentric, and perhaps a little insane. It probably wasn't even true. But at this stage in his exhaustion, he couldn't allow himself to consider any other premise but that of his own indispensability. All the basic concepts of this project were held in his mind and his mind alone. He had to push himself onward until he had closed the last link in the chain. Until... there. The last of Emut's numbers went into the computer. Athor hit the key that brought the 2 orbits up into view simultaneously on the middle screen and hit the key that integrated the new number with the existing patterns. The brilliant red ellipse that was the original theoretical orbit wavered and shifted, and suddenly it was gone. So was the yellow one of the observed orbit. Now there was only a single line on the screen, a deep, intense orange. The 2 orbital simulations overlapping to the last decimal place. Athor gasped. For a long moment he studied the screen, and then he closed his eyes again and bowed his head against the edge of the desk. The orange ellipse blazed like a ring of flame against his closed eyelids. He felt a curious sense of exultation mixed with dismay. He had his answer now. He had a hypothesis that he was certain would stand up to the closest scrutiny. The theory of universal gravitation was valid after all. The epical chain of reasoning on which his fame was based would not be overthrown. But at the same time, he knew now that the model of the solar system with which he was so familiar was in fact erroneous. The unknown factor for which they had sought, the invisible giant, the dragon in the sky, was real. Athor found that profoundly upsetting, even if it had rescued his famous theory. He had thought for years that he fully understood the rhythm of the heavens, and now it was clear to him that his knowledge had been incomplete, that a great strangeness existed in the midst of the known universe, that things were not as he had always believed them to be. It was hard at his age to swallow that. After a time, Athor looked up. Nothing had changed on the screen. He punched in a few interrogative equations, and still nothing changed. He saw 1 orbit, not 2.
"Very well," he told himself. "So the universe is not quite as you thought it was. You'd better rearrange your beliefs then, because you certainly can't rearrange the universe." "Emot," he called. "Faro, Binet, all of you."
Roly-poly little Faro was the first through the door, with Beanpole Emot just behind him, and then the rest of the astronomy department. Binet, Thalanda, Klett, Simbron, and some others. They clustered just inside the entrance to his office. Athor saw by the expression of shock on their faces that he must be a frightful sight indeed. No doubt wild and haggard, his white hair standing out in all directions, his face pale,
his whole appearance that of an old man right on the edge of collapse. It was important to diffuse their fears right away. This was no moment for melodrama. Quietly, he said,
"Yes, I'm very tired, and I know it. And I probably look like some demon out of the nether realms. But I've got something here that looks like it works."
"The gravitational lens idea?" Binet said.
"The gravitational lens is a completely hopeless concept,"
Athor said frostily.
"The same with the burned-out sun, the fold in space, the zone of negative mass, and the other fantastical notions we've been playing with all week. They're all very pretty ideas, but they don't stand up to hard scrutiny. There is one that does, though."
He watched their eyes widen. Turning to the screen, he began once again to set up the numbers of Postulate 8. His weariness dropped away as he worked. He struck no wrong keys this time, felt no aches and pains. He had moved into a realm beyond fatigue.
"In this postulate, we assume,"
he said,
"a non-luminous planetary body similar to Kalgash, which is in orbit not around Onos, but around Kalgash itself. Its mass is considerable. In fact, is nearly the same as that of Kalgash itself, sufficient to exert a gravitational force on our world that causes the perturbations of our orbit, which Binet has called to our attention."
Athor keyed in the visuals, and the solar system appeared on the screen in stylized form. The six suns, Kalgash, and the postulated satellite of Kalgash. He turned back to face the others. They were all looking at each other uneasily. Though they were half his age, or even less, they must be having as much trouble coming to an intellectual and emotional acceptance of the whole idea of another major heavenly body in the universe as he had had. Or else they simply must think he had become senile and somehow had slipped up in his calculations.
"The numbers supporting Postulate 8 are correct,"
Athor said.
"I pledge you that. And the postulate has withstood every test I could apply."
He glared at them defiantly, looking ferociously at each of them in turn, as if to remind them that he was the Athor 77 who had given the world the theory of universal gravitation, and that he had not yet taken leave of his faculties. Binet said softly, "And the reason why we are unable to see this satellite, sir?"
"Two reasons," replied Athor serenely. "Like Kalgash itself, this planetary body would shine only by reflected light. If we assume that its surface is made up largely of bluish rock, not an implausible geological likelihood, then the light reflected from it would be positioned along the spectrum in such a way that the eternal blaze of the six suns, combined with the light-scattering properties of our own atmosphere, would completely mask its presence. In a sky where several suns are shining at virtually every moment, such a satellite would be invisible to us."
Faro said, "Provided the orbit of the satellite is an extremely large one, isn't that so, sir?"
"Right."
Athor keyed in the second visual.
"Here's a closer look. As you see, our unknown and invisible satellite travels around us on an enormous ellipse that carries it extremely far from us for many years at a time. Not so distant that we don't display the orbital effects of its presence in the heavens, but far enough so that ordinarily there is no possibility of our getting a naked eye view of this dim, rocky mass in the sky, and very little possibility of our discovering it, even with our telescopes. Since we have no way of knowing it's there by ordinary observation, it would be only by the wildest chance that we'd have detected it astronomically."
"But of course we can go looking for it now," said Thalanda 191, whose specialty was astrophotography.
"And of course we will,"
Athor told her. They were coming around to the idea now, he saw. Every one of them. He knew them well enough to see that there were no secret scoffers.
"Though you may find the search harder than you suspect. Very definitely a needle-in-a-haystack proposition. But there'll be an immediate appropriation for the work. That I pledge you."
Binet said, "One question, sir."
"Go on."
"If the orbit's as eccentric as your postulate supposes, and therefore this satellite of ours, this Kalgash-2, let's call it for the moment, Kalgash-2 is extremely distant from us during certain parts of its orbital cycle, Well, then it stands to reason that at other parts of its cycle, it's bound to move into a position that's very much closer to us. There has to be some range of variation, even in the most perfect orbit, and a satellite traveling in a large elliptical orbit is likely to have an extreme range between the farthest and the closest points of approach to the primary.
That would be logical, yes,
Athor said.
But then, sir, Binet went on, if we assume that Kalgash 2 has been so far from us during the entire period of modern astronomical science that we've been unable to discover its very existence, except by the indirect means of measuring its effect on our own world's orbit, wouldn't you agree that it's probably coming back from its farthest distance right now, that it must currently be approaching us?
Well, that doesn't necessarily follow, Emot said with a great flurry of his arms. We don't have any idea where it is along its orbital path right now or how long it takes to make one complete circuit around Kalgash. It might be a 10,000-year orbit and Kalgash 2 could still be heading away from us after an approach in prehistoric times that no one remembers.
True, Binet admitted. We can't really say whether it's coming or going at the present moment. Well, not yet, anyway.
But we can try to find out, Faro said. Belinda has the right idea. Even though all the numbers check out, we need to see whether Kalgash 2 is actually out there. Once we find it, we can begin to calculate its orbit.
We should be able to calculate its orbit simply from the perturbations it causes in ours, said Klett, who was the department's best mathematician.
Yes, Simbron put in. She was a cosmographer. And we can also figure out whether it's approaching or heading away from us. Gods, what if it's heading this way? What an amazing event that would be. A dark planetary body cutting across the sky, passing between us and the suns, possibly even blotting out the light of some of them for a couple of hours.
How strange that would be, Binet mused. An eclipse, I suppose you could call it. You know, the visual effect that occurs when some object gets between a viewer and the thing he's looking at.
But could it happen? The suns are so huge, how could Kalgash 2 actually conceal one of them from view?
But if it came close enough to us, it might, Faro said. Why, I imagine a situation in which...
Yes, work out all the possible scenarios, why don't you?
Athor interjected suddenly, cutting Faro off with such brutal abruptness that everyone in the room turned to stare at him.
Play with the idea, all of you. Push it this way and that, and see what you get.
Suddenly, he couldn't bear to sit here any longer. He had to get away. The exhilaration he had felt since putting the last piece into place had abruptly deserted him. He felt a terrible leaden weariness, as though he were 1,000 years old. Chills were running along his arms down into his fingers, and something was squirming frantically in the muscles of his back. He knew that he had pushed himself beyond all endurance now. It was time for younger workers to relieve him of this enterprise. Rising from his chair before the screens, Athor took one uncertain, reeling step toward the middle of the room, recovered himself before he could stumble, and walked slowly and with all the dignity he could muster past the observatory staff.
I'm going home, he said. I could use some sleep.
15. Binet said, am I to understand that the village was destroyed by fire 9 times in a row, Sephira? And they rebuilt it every time?
Well, my colleague Balak thinks there may be only 7 villages piled up on the hill of Thambo, the archaeologist replied. And he may be right, actually. Things are pretty jumbled down toward the lowest levels. But 7 villages, 9 villages, no matter how many it is exactly, it doesn't change the fundamental concept. Here, look at these charts. I've worked them up from my excavation notes. Of course, what we did was just a preliminary dig, a quick slice through the whole hill with the really meticulous work left for a later expedition. We discovered the hill too late in our work to do anything else. But these charts will give you an idea. You aren't going to be bored, are you? All this stuff does interest you, doesn't it, Binet?
I find it completely fascinating.
Do you think I'm so totally preoccupied with astronomy that I can't pay attention to any of the other disciplines? Besides, archaeology and astronomy sometimes go hand in hand. We've learned more than a little about the movements of the suns through the heavens by studying the ancient astronomical monuments that you people have been digging up here and there around the world. Here, let me see.
They were in Sephira's office. She had asked Binet to come there to discuss a problem which she said had unexpectedly arisen in the course of her research, which puzzled him because he didn't immediately see how an astronomer could help an archaeologist in her work despite what he had just said about archaeology and astronomy sometimes going hand in hand. But he was always glad to have a chance to visit with Sephira. They had met initially 5 years before, when they were working together on an interdisciplinary faculty committee that was planning the expansion of the university library. Though Sephira had been out of the country most of the time since then doing field work, she and Binet did enjoy meeting for lunch now and then when she was there. He found her challenging, highly intelligent, and abrasive in a refreshing sort of way. What she saw in him, he had no idea. Perhaps just an intellectually stimulating young man who wasn't involved in the poisonous rivalries and feuds of her own field and had no apparent designs on her body. Sephira unfolded the charts, huge sheets of thin parchment-like paper on which complex, elegant diagrams had been ruled with pencil, and she and Binet bent forward to examine them at close range. He had been telling the truth when he said he was fascinated by archaeology. Ever since he'd been a boy, he had enjoyed reading the narratives of the great explorers of antiquity, such men as Marpin, Shelbeck, and, of course, Galdo 221. He found the remote past nearly as exciting to think about as the remote reaches of interstellar space. His contract mate, Raista, wasn't greatly pleased by his friendship with Sephira. She had rather testily implied a couple of times that it was Sephira herself who fascinated him, not her field of research. But Binet thought Raissa's jealousy was absurd. Certainly, Sephira was an attractive woman. It would be disingenuous to pretend otherwise. But she was relentlessly non-romantic, and every man on campus knew it. Besides, she was something like 10 years older than Binet. Handsome as she was, Binet had never thought of her with any sort of intimate intentions. "What we have here first is a cross-section of the entire hill," Sephira told him. "I've plotted each separate level of occupation in a schematic way. The newest settlements at the top, naturally. Huge stone walls, what we call the Cyclopean style of architecture, typical of the Beklamut culture in its mature period of development. This line here in the level of the Cyclopean walls represents a layer of charcoal remains, enough charcoal to indicate a widespread conflagration that must have utterly wiped the city out. And here, below the Cyclopean level and the burn line, is the next oldest settlement, which is constructed in a different style." "Exactly. You see how I've drawn the stones of the walls? It's what we call the crosshatch style, characteristic of the early Beklamut culture, or perhaps the culture that developed into Beklamut. Both these styles can be seen in the Beklamut-era ruins that surround the Hill of Thambo. The main ruins are Cyclopean, and here and there we found a little crosshatch stuff, just a mere outcropping or two, which we call proto-Beklamut. Now, look here, at the border between the crosshatch settlement and the Cyclopean ruins above it." "Another fire line?" Binet said. "Another fire line, yes. What we have in this hill is like a sandwich, a layer of human occupation, a layer of charcoal, another layer of human occupation, another layer of charcoal. So what I think happened is something like this. During the time of the crosshatch people, there was a devastating fire that scorched a pretty good chunk of the Sejikan Peninsula and forced the abandonment of the Thambo village and other crosshatch-style villages nearby. Afterward, when the inhabitants came back and began to rebuild, they used a brand new and more elaborate architectural style, which we call Cyclopean, because of the huge building stones. But then came another fire and wiped out the Cyclopean settlement. At that point, the people of the area gave up trying to build cities on the Hill of Thambo, and this time when they rebuilt, they chose another site nearby, which we term Beklamut Major. We've believed for a long time that Beklamut Major was the first true human city, emerging from the smaller crosshatch-type proto-Beklamut period settlements scattered all around it. What Thambo tells us is that there was at least one important Cyclopean city in the area before Beklamut Major existed." "And the Beklamut Major site," Binet said, "shows no trace of the fire damage?" "No. So it wasn't there when the city on top of Thambo was burned. Eventually, the whole Beklamut culture collapsed and Beklamut Major itself was abandoned. But that was for other reasons having to do with climatic shifts. Fire had nothing to do with it. That was perhaps 1,000 years ago. But the fire that wrecked the topmost Thambo village seems to have been much earlier than that. I'd guess about 1,000 years earlier. The radiocarbon dates from the charcoal samples, will give us a more precise figure when we get them from the lab. And the crosshatch settlement? How old is that? Orthodox archaeological belief has been that the fragmentary crosshatch structures we've found here and there on the Sajikan Peninsula are only a few generations older than the Peklemat Major site. After the Thambo excavation, I don't think so. My guess is that the crosshatch settlement on that hill is 2,000 years older than the Cyclopean buildings on top of it. 2,000? And you say that there are other settlements below that one?
Look at the chart, Sephara said.
Here's number 3, a kind of architecture we've never seen before. Nothing at all like crosshatch work. Then another burn line. Settlement number 4 and a burn line. Number 5, a burn line. Then numbers 6, 7, 8, and 9. Or if Balik's reading is correct, just numbers 6 and 7. And each one destroyed by a great fire. That seems pretty remarkable to me. A deadly cycle of destruction striking again and again and again in the same place. The remarkable thing, said Sephara in a curiously somber tone, is that each of these settlements appears to have flourished for approximately the same length of time before being destroyed by fire. The layers of occupation are quite extraordinarily similar in thickness. We're still waiting for the lab reports, you understand, but I don't think my eyeball estimate is very far off, and Balik's figures are the same as mine. Unless we're completely mistaken, we're looking at a minimum of 14,000 years of prehistory in the Hill of Thambo. And during those 14,000 years, the hill was periodically swept by massive fires that forced its abandonment with clockwork regularity. One fire every 2,000 years, just about exactly. What? A shiver ran along Binet's spine. His mind was beginning to leap to all manner of improbable and disturbing conclusions. Wait, Sephara said. There's more. She opened a drawer and took out a stack of glossy photographs. These are the pictures of the Thambo tablets. Mudrin 505 has the originals. The paleographer, you know. He's been trying to decipher them. They're made of baked clay. We found these 3 in level 3 and these in level 5. They're both written in extremely primitive scripts, and the writing on the older ones is so ancient that Mudrin can't even make a start on them. But he's been able very tentatively to puzzle out a couple of dozen words from the level 3 tablets, which are written in an early form of the Beklemat script. So far as he can tell at this point, they're an account of the destruction of a city by fire, the work of angry gods who periodically find it necessary to punish mankind for wickedness. Periodically? That's right. Does it begin to sound familiar? The Apostles of Flame! My God, Sephara, what have you stumbled on here? That's what I've been asking myself since Mudrin brought me the first sketchy translations. The archaeologist swung around to face Binet, and for the first time Binet saw how bleary her eyes were, how tense and drawn her face. She looked almost distraught. Do you see now why I asked you to come here? I can't talk about this with anyone in the department. Binet, what am I going to do? If any of this becomes public, Mandior 71 and his whole crazy crew will proclaim it from the rooftops that I've discovered firm archaeological proof of their crackpot theories. You think so? What else? Sephara tapped the charts. Here's evidence of repeated fiery destruction at 2,000-year intervals, roughly over a period of many thousands of years. And these tablets, the way it looks now, they might actually be some sort of prehistoric version of the Book of Revelations. Taken together, they provide, if not actual confirmation of the rantings of the apostles, then at least a solid rational underpinning for their whole mythology. But repeated fires at a single site don't prove that there was worldwide devastation, Binet objected. It's the periodicity that worries me, said Sephara. It's too neat and too close to what Mandior's been saying. I've been looking at the Book of Revelations. The Sajikan Peninsula is a holy place to the apostles. Did you know that? The sacred site where the gods formerly made themselves visible to humanity, so they say. And therefore it stands to reason... Oh, listen to me. It stands to reason, she said, laughing bitterly, that the gods would preserve Sajikan as a warning to mankind of the doom that will come again and again if we don't alter our wicked ways. Binet stared at her, stunned. He knew very little about the apostles and their teachings, really. Such pathological fantasizing had never held any interest for him, and he had been too busy with his scientific work to pay heed to Mondior's windy apocalyptic prophecies.
But now the memory of the conversation he had had some weeks before with Theramon 762 at the Six Suns Club burst with furious impact into his consciousness.
Won't be the first time the world has been destroyed. The gods have deliberately made mankind imperfect and given us a single year